If you're having trouble hearing our updates on Hurricane Gustav or the Republican convention today, maybe it's because you've got a little too much earwax. That's why we're presenting guidelines for the removal of impacted earwax. Here's NPR's Joe Palca.
First, let's be clear. Earwax isn't really wax. It's, technically speaking, desquamated sheets of corneocytes from the external auditory canal mixed with glandular secretions. Or, put another way, dead skin cells and goo. One thing that is true about earwax, it is ubiquitous. But don't just take it from me.
Earwax is ubiquitous.
Richard Rosenfeld is an ear, nose, and throat specialist and an author of the new guidelines put together by the American Academy of Otolaryngology Head and Neck Surgery Foundation. Besides being ubiquitous, Rosenfeld says earwax is good for you.
Earwax is a naturally occurring product that cleans, protects, and lubricates your ear canal, so it's very beneficial.
But there are times when earwax builds up, blocking off the ear canal entirely. Rosenfeld says patients with impacted earwax may experience a sense of fullness in the ear, hearing loss, or pain.
Other things that do occur are some ringing in the ear, also known as tinnitus. Some dizziness can occur, and even coughing, because there are little nerve fibers in the ear canal that actually are common to your diaphragm.
It's easy enough for a doctor to look in your ear and see if the wax is the cause of these symptoms. If so, it's time to remove it. Now here's a quiz. Your ear's stopped up, it's driving you mad. What's the best tool to remove it? A. A jackhammer. B. A pneumatic drill. Or C. An ice pick. I'll give you a hint. It's not C.
That is correct. No ice picks.
Okay, none of the above. But Rosenfeld says people do use some strange and potentially dangerous techniques for removing earwax.
Other harmful devices are the oral jet irrigators that people often use to clean their gums for dental purposes.
You mean something like a water pick?
Exactly. It's quite popular to squirt that in your ear.
Rosenfeld says doing so runs a significant risk of damaging your eardrum.
The granddaddy of all the bad things to do are the so-called ear candles.
An ear candle is a hollow, paraffin-covered cylinder. You put it in your ear and light it. Supposedly, this causes a suction in the tube that draws out the earwax. In fact, Rosenfeld says it doesn't work. And you can light your hair on fire if you're not careful. One more bad but extremely popular idea, trying to dig out the wax with a Q-tip. Dan McCarter is a family physician with the University of Virginia Health System. He's the author of a recent article on how to remove earwax. He says not only will a Q-tip not get the wax out, it'll make things worse.
It's almost like using a tamping rod and a cannon. They're tamping it down further in the ear.
So how does McCarter remove earwax?
If I can actually see it and it's not too far down in the ear, is I like using a little tool called alligator forceps.
A kind of fancy tweezer.
If that works, it's very quick. If it doesn't work, then I usually irrigate the ears.
Irrigation involves injecting a steady stream of water into the ear and flushing out the wax. Both approaches are approved in the new guidelines. We can only hope that if this country's future leaders experience any of the symptoms of impacted earwax, they'll seek the advice of a trained professional, such as Dr. McCarter or Dr. Rosenfeld. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
We've been spending part of this year remembering one of the most tumultuous years in our history, 1968, 40 years ago. It was the year of the murders of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy. It was a year of riots and anti-war protests. There were also cultural upheavals, which were visible on the silver screen. And that's our subject in the latest report in our series, Echoes of 1968. Here's NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg.
The 1968 Academy Awards ceremony was postponed for 2 days because of Martin Luther King's assassination. When the time came to name the Oscar winner for Best Picture, the list included films with lines that have lasted low these many years.
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
The Graduate, directed by Mike Nichols, a film that defined generation gap.
This year's Miss Bonnie Parker.
Glad to meet you.
I'm Clyde Barrow.
Clyde.
We rob banks.
Bonnie and Clyde, directed by Arthur Penn, a folktale of Depression-era robbery and bloodshed.
and it never occurred to me that I might fall in love with a Negro. But I did, and nothing in the world is going to change that.
Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, directed by Stanley Kramer. Interracial marriage in a liberal and patrician white family.
Virgil, that's a funny name for a nigger boy that comes from Philadelphia. What do they call you up there?
They call me Mr. Tibbs.
In the Heat of the Night, directed by Norman Jewison, about racial tensions and murder in a small Mississippi town. Oh, yes, and this one.
It's incredible. It's impossible. But it's true. A man can talk to the animals.
Dr. Doolittle, directed by Richard Fleischer, about, you know. And the Oscar went to In the Heat of the Night. In many ways, the tamest film of the bunch. Other Best Picture nominees were hotter, bolder. In a book about 60s movie making, Mark Harris says Hollywood then mostly meant World War II stories, westerns, and epics. So some of those new films were revolutionary.
I think the revolution was that movies finally started to catch up with what was going on in the culture at large.
Civil rights were much on people's minds in the late 60s, more so than the Vietnam War, at least in movie theaters. And Heat of the Night was about race as well as whodunit. But in his book, Pictures at a Revolution, Five Movies and the Birth of the New Hollywood, Mark Harris says the real competition that 1968 Oscar night was for the future of movie making.
I think there was a general sense that Bonnie and Clyde and The Graduate were going to be more lasting achievements than In the Heat of the Night, which was, I think, seen as a very skillful, traditional Hollywood mystery with a good liberal message in it.
Bonnie and Clyde was revolutionary, influenced by a new wave of gritty, realistic foreign films. Audiences fell in love with the gorgeous protagonists, Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway playing Robin Hoods, whose Robin ways end in a shockingly prolonged volley of bullets. Their first holdup is a farce.
They go into the bank. They say,
stick up.
Nobody hears them. So they have to say it louder and get everybody's attention.
Yes, sir, a stick up.
Meanwhile, their inept getaway driver is trying to parallel park the getaway car. But when they come out of the bank with all the money to make their getaway, they don't know where he's parked.
Hi, where's the car?
When they finally get into the car, you're laughing. Then the bank manager jumps onto the rear windshield.
Clyde turns around and shoots him, and you see the bullet go through the windshield and the lens of his eyeglasses, and his face explodes in blood.
Bang, the laughter stops. The movie goes ugly and disoriented. Bang, a new kind of filmmaking. Mark Harris says The Graduate, another Best Picture nominee at the 1968 Oscar ceremonies, was revolutionary in several ways.
The Graduate, perhaps more than any of the five movies, really did change things because, if nothing else, it was the biggest hit of the five. In fact, by the end of its run, which was, I think, two full years in theaters, it was the third highest grossing movie in history.
Upper-middle-class L.A., disaffected college grad seduced by older woman falls in love with her daughter. Sure. But here's the revolution. The story is told from a new point of view.
Suddenly, the kind of camera had shifted, and this was looking at the generation gap now from the other side of the generation gap, from the young side.
And there's more. Young people raced to see The Graduate. Hollywood discovered a new audience.
And that was who movies started to get made for after that.
Have you thought about graduate school?
No.
Would you mind telling me then what those 4 years of college were for? What was the point of all that hard work?
You got me.
Have you given any thought to the problems your children are going to have?
Yes, and they'll have some.
Sidney Poitier and Spencer Tracy in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner.
Is that the way Joey feels?
She feels that every single one of our children will be president of the United States, and they'll all have colorful administrations.
Guess Who's Coming to Dinner almost didn't get made. Here's how the director's widow tells the story. Karen Kramer says Hollywood wasn't ready for a film about interracial marriage. The topic, in certain places in America then, was taboo and illegal, and Stanley Kramer knew it.
He was afraid to tell Columbia Pictures what the subject matter was completely about because, look, as an investment for Columbia Pictures, it can't play in 16 states in this country or it would cause riots. It's not a good investment for a studio. So he would tap dance his way out of giving them a screenplay. And he said, look, I've got Spencer Tracy, I've got Catherine Hepburn, I've got Sidney Poitier, and it's a love story. well, is it not a love story? It is a love story. But he didn't want to give them the script because he knew that they would have objections to it.
Eventually, according to Karen Kramer, her husband had no choice. He handed over the script. The film was canceled. Columbia claimed they were worried about Spencer Tracy's health. He'd been ill for many years. Stanley Kramer felt that was a cover. He had an idea. The director and his wife went to see Katharine Hepburn.
And he said, Kate, look it. I'm going to put up my salary as collateral for this film. And will you do the same? And she said, are you serious? He said, yes. And she said, I will too.
The film got made. Months before Guess Who's Coming to Dinner was released, the Supreme Court said laws forbidding miscegenation were unconstitutional. And Karen Kramer says real life helped the film in another way.
Dean Rusk, who was Secretary of State in 1968's daughter, married another Stanford student who just happened to be black. It made the front page in every newspaper in this country.
In the summer of 1968, the Beatles sang about revolution. But even before that, a revolution in movie making was playing on the silver screens of America. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
You can find scenes from those Best Picture nominees at NPR.org. This next story is a reminder that in law enforcement, the good guys often have to rely on bad guys, confidential informants. Many of the best informants are ruthless criminals. And while their information helps the FBI to crack cases, the practice of using these informants is fraught with risk. And that risk is where we begin a series this morning on confidential informants. NPR's Dina Temple-Raston has been looking at the FBI's confidential informant program. And this morning she'll report on how a single case in Boston changed the way that agents work with criminals.
Crooked agents in league with a mob boss is the FBI's worst nightmare. But that's exactly what happened in Boston in the 1970s. The godfather of the city's Irish mob, Whitey Bulger, became a confidential informant for the FBI and in the process managed to corrupt two agents, John Connolly and his boss John Morris. Jim Ring was a supervisor in the Boston FBI office at the time.
I was asked a question at a trial, a civil trial, in which I was testifying. What was my first reaction when I heard that John Morris admitted taking money from them? My answer was, I started to throw up.
The FBI's unholy alliance with Whitey Bulger all started with a meet at Wollaston Beach on Boston's south side. It was 1975, and FBI agent John Connolly had asked Bulger to meet him at the beach parking lot, just a short walk from the housing projects in Southie, where the two men had grown up. It was late at night, no one was around, and all that could be heard were waves slapping on the shore. Connolly had driven to the beach in the middle of the night to convince Bulger to become a top echelon informant. That's someone who provides the FBI with firsthand information about high-level organized crime figures. Connolly didn't think Bulger would rat out the Irish mob, but he did get him to agree to provide information on the rival Italian mafia. That meeting was the beginning of the relationship that would end up fundamentally changing the FBI's confidential informant program. From the moment Jim Ring heard Connolly was working Bulger as an informant, he was worried.
I told him, information goes one way. Informants are not consultants. They're not friends. They're informants. The agent remembers that and treats them accordingly.
But the information didn't go one way. For almost 30 years, Connolly and Bulger had an unholy alliance. Bulger provided tips that helped the FBI dismantle the Italian mob, and Connolly protected Bulger from investigations by the FBI and other agencies. He needed to keep Bulger out of jail so he could keep getting tips from him. Valerie Caproni is the FBI's general counsel.
I think what the Whitey Bulger case did was it really shined a light on the relationship between the Bureau and informants. They are killers, they are liars, they're cheaters. And those are the people who are informants. And so I think, in part, the problem with the Whitey Bulger case was people looked at the relationship and were appalled.
The case rocked the FBI to its core. The wave of negative publicity forced the Justice Department to take a hard look at the use of informants and how agents dealt with them. That review produced a set of guidelines that agents say are so strict they gut the program.
The unfortunate thing, I think, is that whenever you have something like this, there tends to be an overreaction.
Barry Mann is a retired assistant director at the FBI. He worked in the Boston field office when a federal judge started looking into the FBI's relationship with Bulger in 1997. The guidelines grew out of that investigation.
Well, when you start to put a lot of guidelines and a lot more rules and make it very difficult, then the agents, for that reason as well as for some other reasons, tend to shy away.
Jim Ring said he would go through the guidelines to show me some of the reasons why agents are so upset. Today, Ring works for a prominent law firm in Boston. He's sitting in an office that is profoundly quiet. The view outside is nothing but Boston Harbor, water as far as the eye can see.
I'm looking through the guidelines.
Flipping through the 28 single-spaced pages of guidelines, he stops at a section about informants committing crimes. The guidelines say the FBI has to authorize any crimes informants commit while working with the FBI. Ring says the rule makes sense if you have a drug informant who needs to sell a nickel bag as part of a case. But for top echelon informants, he says the rule seems naive.
So if I'm going to have a capo as an informant in the La Cosa Nostra, am I to assume that he's going to say, okay, I won't commit crime?
He says that defeats the purpose. The reason top echelon informants are so valuable is precisely because they are in the middle of a criminal enterprise. Crime is all around them. In most cases, they are violating racketeering statutes just for being a member of the mob. He flips to another section.
Let me read you something out of the guidelines. The United States government will strive to protect your identity, but cannot promise or guarantee either that your identity will not be divulged or that you will not be called to testify in a proceeding as a witness.
Ring throws up his hands.
Now, if you were considering doing business with me as a member of Al-Qaeda or a capo in the La Cosa Nostra, would you want to do business with me after I told you that?
NPR spoke to more than a dozen current FBI agents who echoed Ring's remarks, saying they can't develop confidential informants if they can't protect their identities. In some cases, asking them to testify would be tantamount to giving them a death sentence. Their criminal organizations would have them killed. Again, the FBI's Valerie Caproni.
Agents sometimes like to complain, and this is something they can complain about, that the rules have changed a little bit. It's laid out much more clearly when they will have to disclose the source's identity. But I think as a general rule, we have a very good track record with maintaining the confidentiality of the identities of human sources.
Ring says that if the FBI wants to get insiders from Al-Qaeda or the mob to help them fight crime, they need to put what happened in Boston in the past. Agents need to be allowed to use their judgment.
The result is they have tried by legislation to make what Morris and Connolly did impossible. And I think that is impossible to do because corruption is a matter of the heart.
New Attorney General guidelines on a variety of FBI procedures are expected to be released in the next couple of weeks. In spite of agents' complaints, Caproni says the confidential informant guidelines won't change. Dina Temple-Raston, NPR News.
You can see photos of some of these characters as well as places where Bulger did business on our website at npr.org. The series continues tomorrow on Morning Edition. NPR's Dina Temple-Raston looks at the legal liabilities for agents who develop confidential sources.
As someone said to me, after this happened to you, I would never touch an informant.
News from the McCain campaign that Sarah Palin's 17-year-old unmarried daughter, Bristol, is pregnant. In a statement released by the McCain campaign, Sarah Palin and her husband Todd say they're, quote, proud of Bristol's decision to have her baby and even prouder to become grandparents. And NPR's Scott Horsley is with the McCain campaign in Philadelphia. Scott, tell us more about this statement from the Palins. What else is there?
Well, Alec, this is something that had been rumored in the 72 hours or so since John McCain announced his choice of Governor Palin to be his running mate. There have also been other rumors about the governor and her daughters, and the campaign says they wanted to set the record straight. So as you say, Sarah Palin and her husband Todd put out a statement today confirming that their 17-year-old daughter Bristol, who is not married, is expecting a child. It's a Labor Day surprise. It's not something that was revealed at the time that she was announced as the running mate. But Governor Palin and her husband went on to say that as Bristol faces the responsibilities of adulthood, she knows she has their unconditional love and support.
Elsewhere, this statement does say that the daughter, Bristol, is planning to marry the young man who's the father of her baby to come.
That's right, and that I'm sure will be reassuring to a lot of social conservatives who, as we just heard John Dickerson say, have really been rallying around Governor Palin as the vice presidential nominee.
So, Scott, here's a question. Do you know, did Governor Palin know about her daughter's condition when she accepted the vice presidential nomination?
Well, of course, that was the first question everyone was asking, because there has been some suspicion about just how thoroughly the McCain campaign had vetted Sarah Palin. She and the senator met for only the first time back in January, and Senator McCain had only one face-to-face meeting with Governor Palin last week before he offered her the spot on the ticket. John McCain's spokeswoman, Jill Hazelbaker, told NPR the senator was aware that Governor Palin would become a grandmother when he chose her. The campaign says McCain didn't view that as a disqualification for the spot on the ticket. And another McCain advisor says McCain views this as a private family matter.
What about the likely political impact of the news? It's just broken there. What's going around there in the press scrum?
Well, I think, as we say, social conservatives may continue to rally around Governor Palin, and in particular, Bristol's decision to keep the baby and to marry the young man who's the child's father. On the other side of the fence, I'm sure there will be people pointing out that Governor Palin has been a strong advocate for abstinence-only sex education in school, and this will merely add to their argument that such programs are not tremendously effective.
NPR's Scott Horsley with the McCain campaign in Philadelphia on the news that his vice presidential candidate, Sarah Palin's daughter, is now pregnant with a child. Scott, thanks.
My pleasure, Alex.
Finally this hour, a trip to the theater, a marionette theater. It's a summertime tradition in France, especially for young kids, watching the antics of a character named Guignol. Reporter Eleanor Beardsley took in a performance with a special guest, her 2-year-old son.
Under a colorful tent in the town square of the small Atlantic coast village of Cap Ferret, a couple dozen children sit in tiny chairs looking up at a marionette theater. Their parents sit in large chairs behind them. The children's eyes grow wide as the matinee performance of Guignol begins.
Ooh, la 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 la. Ah oui, et je m'appelle comment? Eh oui, c'est moi Guignol. Alors on dit bonjour Guignol. Bonjour mes petits amis. Ça va bien les petits amis?
Guignol turns 200 this year. Made from solid lime tree wood, the playful marionette has big brown eyes, a long ponytail, and a gentle smile. He is as well known to French children as any Walt Disney character. Traveling performances like this one play all summer long in vacation spots across the country. François Dupin is behind the curtain doing the voices for all the characters in today's play. Dupin makes his living on the road with his wife, 3 sons, and Guignol.
Oh, ben, en été, on donne des petits spectacles comme ça sur la côte. Oui, des Landes.
In the summer, we give performances all along the West Coast. In the winter, we perform in primary schools.
Dupin comes from a circus family, and his grandmother was in a Guignol troupe. He says Guignol is less physically challenging than the circus, but there are still standards to meet.
You have to speak good French while you're amusing the children, and you have to get the children to participate in the play.
Guignol was created in 1808 by a tooth puller from Lyon who said he preferred to make people laugh than cry. The marionette was born out of the great satirical theatrical traditions of the city at that time.
Oh, je l'ai perdu, les petits amis, je l'ai perdu.
Guignol puppeteers work from an official Guignol repertoire with hundreds of plots. The cast of characters always includes a baron in his chateau, a gendarme, and a crafty villain, usually a robber. Using his guile and with the help of the children, Guignol always outwits the thief in the end. Under the tent today, Laurence Boris holds her frightened two-year-old son in her lap. Her four-year-old daughter has been one of the biggest yellers today.
J'ai vu Guignol quand j'étais petite, à l'âge de mes enfants.
I always went to see Guignol when I was their age. It's really a part of the French culture. Guignol also means vacation time, when you're with your parents or grandparents and doing something different from the rest of the year.
My own son, who can't even talk yet, joins in heartily to yell at the villain. Guignol might hit robbers over the head with a stick, but his vocabulary is nice and he always throws in a good old-fashioned moral lesson.
Oh, et bien, les petits amis, vous voyez, c'est pour cela, dans la vie.
You see, my little friends, it never pays to steal, Guignol tells the children, and you should always obey your mama and your papa, because mean little girls and boys always end up in prison. And on that sweet note, Guignol bids his audience farewell.
Au revoir, les petits amis!
For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley.
Au revoir! Au revoir, au revoir!
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block. On today's program, we've been covering Hurricane Gustav and developments in the presidential race and the Republican convention. Now, at the end of this hour, we're going to take a break from the news to hear about movies. It's that time when fall films start coming out, the serious ones hoping to score the perfect combination of Oscar buzz and box office gold. Bob Mondello has this selective preview of what's in store for the fall.
Oscar season looming, and oh, the drama, epics, westerns, war movies, and that masterpiece theater sensibility in the 18th century melodrama,
The Duchess of Devonshire.
Keira Knightley is a British aristocrat who dabbles in politics.
How's the campaign doing?
Terribly.
Perhaps we could use my ability to draw attention to our advantage.
Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Mr. Charles Grey.
Change is upon us.
One thing that change apparently doesn't affect is campaign rhetoric. Other films with a political bent this fall include Milk, the real-life tragedy of assassinated gay leader Harvey Milk, played by Sean Penn, and director Oliver Stone, who's explored the legacies of past presidents in his films JFK and Nixon, offers a comic portrait of a sitting president in W.
Harding, chasing tail, driving drunk.
I got it. Oh!
Who do you think you are?
A Kennedy?
You're a Bush. Act like one.
While Oliver Stone skewers a political dynasty, director Barry Levinson will skewer Hollywood in What Just Happened? With talent agent Robert De Niro fending off daily catastrophe.
Talk to me.
You're not going
to
believe it. He's fat.
Bruce Willis is overweight?
With a Grizzly Adams beard.
Audiences want to know it's you, Bruce.
What are you talking about? They're not going to recognize me, Ben? Oh, where'd Bruce go? Oh, look, there he is. I see him right there, the guy with the beard.
Credit Willis with being a good sport. Other fall comedies include an updated remake of the 1930s backbiting sensation, The Women, without Claire Booth Luce's dialogue, which seems a shame, but with a cast that includes Meg Ryan, Jada Pinkett Smith, Bette Midler, and Candace Bergen.
I heard what happened.
I ordered you a gimlet.
I know, you don't drink in the afternoon, but you will eventually, so why not start now?
Also going for laughs are the Coen brothers, who appear to be in a Fargo frame of mind with their CIA versus gym rats comedy, Burn After Reading, and British director Mike Lee, whose happy-go-lucky is about a woman so relentlessly cheerful, she's almost alarming.
Have you ever had a driving lesson before?
Yeah. No, wasn't really a lesson.
You know, you can make jokes while you're driving, but you will crash and you will die laughing.
Well, if you're gonna go, that's the best way to go, I suppose.
Happy-Go-Lucky has been getting rapturous reviews in Europe. The word is more mixed on Charlie Kaufman's Synecdoche, New York, but the concept's pretty cool. It's about a theater director who tries to recreate Manhattan life-size in a warehouse. Word is that director Jonathan Demme is in peak form with his domestic drama, Rachel Getting Married, about a family's black sheep returning to the fold. And Spike Lee will have an intriguing change of pace with Miracle at St. Anna, a World War II drama in which black soldiers get separated from their unit after one of them risks his life to save a child.
American.
We are Italians.
You got a boy that needs help. I don't know how the hell we got past German lines, but we're surrounded.
You ain't got to be scared. Feel that magic. All you got to do is believe in it.
World War II's Pacific Front is represented in Baz Luhrmann's sweeping epic, Australia, starring the Down Under stars Nicole Kidman and Hugh Jackman, and another Australian actor, Russell Crowe, will play a duplicitous American in a more current war, battling Al-Qaeda with Leo DiCaprio in Body of Lies.
A global war requires constant diligence in order to suppress. Our allegedly unsophisticated enemy has realized that we are an easy target. Our world is a lot simpler to put to an end than you might think.
That's a sentiment that will be borne out rather literally in a series of cinematic apocalypses. A plague darkens humanity's outlook in blindness.
What's the matter?
I can't see. Somehow that patient infected me.
That's impossible. Nobody goes blind like that.
Morning, Minister. Some strange calls this morning.
My fellow citizens, like so many of you, I have gone blind.
And if that isn't sufficiently apocalyptic, there's Cormac McCarthy's The Road, in which a father trudges with his young son across an America that can no longer sustain life. And if you prefer your apocalypse now, well, what better evidence could there be of the end of life as we know it than High School Musical 3?
Right now I can hardly breathe.
Oh, you can do it, just know that I believe.
More down-to-earth teenagers inhabit the romantic comedy Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist, played by Michael Cera and Kat Dennings, fresh-faced stars in a season with lots of star turns. Jamie Foxx as a homeless musical prodigy in The Soloist, Greg Kinnear as an abused inventor in Flash of Genius, Viggo Mortensen and Ed Harris as Western lawmen in Appaloosa, and Angelina Jolie as the distressed mother of a kidnapped child in The Changeling.
Well, aren't you gonna...
That's not my son.
Well, I'm sure you're mistaken.
I'm not mistaken.
Boy, he's been through 5 terrible long months. He's lost weight. He's changed.
I would know my own son.
With quite a few children in peril at the multiplex this fall, it's probably a good thing that there are also films for children. Talking Pooches in Beverly Hills Chihuahua, animated lions, zebras, and hippos in Madagascar Escape to Africa, and an animated superhero puppy who doesn't know he's just an actor in Bolt.
You'll never see Penny again!
And cut!
Oh, don't let him out! He's never been off this set before!
I'm coming, Penny!
Production of the hit television show Bolt shut down today when its star dog went missing.
Kid pictures generally make big bucks in the fall, but they're unlikely to best the season's one guaranteed blockbuster, headed by a hero who's also gone missing, as it happens, in an adventure that picks up just moments after we last saw him in Casino Royale. We're talking 007.
Restrict Bond's movements. Put a stop on his passports. Find Bond.
How long have I got?
30 seconds.
Well, that doesn't give us a lot of time.
The title is Quantum of Solace, a mouthful, but the producers promise more gadgets, more gorgeous women, more Daniel Craig, and more of the original theme music that the last 007 movie was so short on. Can you wait? I'm Bob Mondello.